Hi everyone, my name is Ian Curtis from Enantech and you're watching some of our CES 2016 coverage. Now, as a special treat for you, we've managed to get roped together some really interesting people with ASUS as part of their 10 years of ROG, which they're celebrating this year. And we have a decade of Enantech senior motherboard editors around this table. So I've been doing it for the best part of 5 years now. And to my left is Rajinder Gill, who was motherboard editor from 08 to 2011.
Yes.
You're now in technical marketing, PR, and in the forums, and speaking to end users and sorting issues, and
yes,
and back at headquarters with
He's our evangelist.
But you also get dirty and deep with the overclocking.
Yeah.
To Rajinder's left is Gary Key, who 2005 to 2009.
Yes.
And you were the senior motherboard editor when ASUS first launched ROG.
Yes, I was.
And you went through the thick and the thin and the up and the down.
Yes, and all of it in between. So,
no, it's I'm really interested to hear, you know, just how you felt when those boards first came to market.
It's an interesting story, and I'll just say that ROG has come so far. It's been incredible, the journey that's occurred in the last 10 years.
And sitting to your left, we have Vivian Lin, who's the Chief Marketing Officer for ASUS USA. But Vivian was the PR contact to Gary when Gary was reviewing ROG motherboards.
That's right.
So you handed him his first sample.
Yes, and I remember many conversations about why certain things don't work, trying to figure out from several states away.
Yes.
And I've been with ASUS since 2007, so I've had the privilege to watch the brand grow in terms of our product portfolio as well as our customer base.
And you've had the unfortunate privilege of working with us three.
It's been wonderful.
And so part of the reason why I've got these guys together is because we've all tested ROG motherboards, and Vivian has been on that sort of front line for ROG for so many years, being involved in how it goes through North America. And I want to talk to these guys, you know, ROG through the years. What's changed? What's new? How does it evolve into the future? And so I want to start by talking by essentially, well, we've got a series of motherboards here. And this first one is the Rampage Extreme. This was Gary's review.
It was one of mine. Started out with the Striker.
With the Striker,
yes.
And this came the year afterwards.
Yes.
Yeah. It was about a year after.
It was about a year afterwards.
Can you remember how it was 6-7 years ago to review an ROG product?
That's kind of difficult, you know. I'm old, so I have to get the squirrels wound up in my head. But no, it was the first Rampage board, and it was a significant improvement over the Striker series.
And this is Core 2 Duo platform.
Yes.
Socket 775.
Right.
And at the time, ROG overclocking focused primarily at the time.
It was overclocking first.
Yeah.
But they had started really getting serious about addressing the needs of the gamers with improved audio.
Yeah.
Extremely good stability for this particular platform. And the aesthetics changed greatly over that of the Striker series.
Being such a new product, I mean, we've just had a discussion about this, but when ROG came to market, it was that sort of new element, that new, and nobody had ever necessarily done a gaming focused platform at the time. PC gaming was well known, but wasn't necessarily that high end feature product. How do you introduce that sort of gaming mentality, especially something like ROG, to the market at such a time?
Well, at the time, we took a lot of cues from the gamers, actually. You know, we looked around the market. There were motherboards that were capable of overclocking, motherboards that were purely on the aesthetic side. we saw an opportunity to offer a little bit of both in one package. And so really that was the start of it. Our guys, they on average spend majority of their time, you know, really in the communities interacting with the users and getting feedback from them. And so we had to go through several iterations to get it right, to be honest with you. We had to find, like Gary said, in order to get that best audio quality, we had to find the right chip. We had to find the right design, and so which led to a lot of the innovation throughout that process. So, you know, the beauty of RG is that it didn't happen over time. It happened, I mean, you know, here we are celebrating 10 years of RG, right? It's taken us 10 years to get to where we are today, and you know, we still have a lot of work to do.
I remember reading somewhere that it took several years for RG to even be that sort of profitable level product that features in that sort of Asus high-end space. Given how gaming is just, it's keeping the PC industry afloat in many regards. People say it's declining. People say gaming is bringing it up to the next, bring it up to that level. Do you think, how do you see that's going to extend over the next 5 years, especially when it comes to things like ROG? Is there still going to be that market for that high-end gaming platform?
Well, so first of all, I think, you know, like you said, the gamers have changed a lot. I remember when we first started with ROG, the gaming de facto was a LAN party in the garage.
Yeah.
Or every now and then, you know, you pick up your gear and then you lug around to go to a LAN party and to game with a larger crowd. And now we're seeing esports taking off and a lot of the gaming is done online. I think, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, depending on the type of games and, you know, the emphasis in terms of performance, in terms of the networking performance, in terms of audio, going back to audio again, or the visual experience, all these things are starting to become more and more important, or I should say more important than ever before. Whereas, you know, when, 10 years ago at the time, the big thing was we're going to overclock the CPU, the memory, and whatever else we can overclock.
Yeah.
Well, overclocking being, you know, one of the main focal points of the really high-end ROG products. I mean, now the ROG product stack has that high-end overclocking in gaming, and then you have some more gaming focus, some more form factor focus, like the Impact, and we recently reviewed the Impact. But all of that requires a level of engineering. I mean, every company, every motherboard company gives, you know, the press releases where they say, oh, we've got this new high-end this, we've got this new high-end that. But I know, Raj, you actually spend a lot of time in Taiwan headquarters, being an overclocker, an extreme overclocker, and being that enthused into the market. I mean, that's how I met you. I met you personally through the UK overclocking.
It was at another vendor's event, yes.
I remember eating pizza.
Yeah.
Pizza with you. And
yeah, that's how it all started.
Spoken on the forums we'd never met previously, and it's like, hey, you're Roger.
Yeah, my relationship with Asus R&D goes back to all the time I was writing, because at the time, overclocking was slightly different. It was a more complicated thing to do. And a lot of the stuff that was available at the time that ROG took birth sometimes needed almost an engineering degree to understand. That allowed people like myself, that I'm a bit of a tinkerer, it allowed me to start explaining how to use that stuff to certain end users. I think the ROG brand at the time, I had just started with an Antec. They recognized the fact that they needed to make some of that stuff more available and easily accessible.
Yeah, I mean, I remember overclocking those sort of.
Yeah,
is this socket 775 back? It was difficult.
Yeah, DFI boards, GTLs, all of that stuff was very tricky. Yeah. If you read the reviews on an Antec, you'll see a lot of that stuff in there.
More than just three options.
Yeah, exactly. So you needed people to explain and write guides on how to do that. I think we needed products in the marketplace that made that simplistic and available. Over the years, of course, how overclocking affects a platform has changed. Back in those days, there was more tangible gains at times because it's just the way the architectures were. So the products have reflected that in how they have evolved, right?
Yeah.
As things have changed, if you look at the three boards in front of us, this is a board that never saw the light of day, but it's an interesting one.
Actually, I want to talk about this because you literally showed it to me 20 minutes ago.
Yes.
10 minutes ago, and so I've always been a strong advocate of motherboard companies doing
technological showcases, showing things that could happen if they had infinite time, money, and engineers.
Yes.
And I get the impression from you that this was sort of that halfway house between that end product and the technological showcase, because this was intended to be sold.
Yes.
But it just you just ran out of time and manpower to be able to do it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it, if I can show this to the camera, this is an X79 motherboard, and it has what looks like extra DRAM slots.
Yes.
On the side, you've got this power delivery fan heatsink. Could you imagine sticking this on the motherboard now? What would happen?
Yeah.
And, you know, four-way graphics and
all, and everything else.
All the good stuff. But it explain the process in to go in goes behind working on such a product for so long.
Mm.
And, you know, having the ideas, making sure the ideas work.
Yes.
But then ultimately the product being canned because you can't finish it in time.
There's always learnings to be had. The reason this board is important is it reflects a lot of the work we have to do for each architecture. This particular board, on it is loads of voltage read points.
Yep.
That's how many things we opened up on the platform, right? A lot of those are references. Yes, yeah. They're signal lines. So during the R&D process, we start manipulating all of that stuff. This is all outside specifications. This is extra work a vendor has to do to find how to increase performance margins or give more overclocking headroom. So a lot of this research, sometimes it carries on from platform to platform. And what happens is we take the very best of what we find here that affects a platform, and it makes it into a retail product. So while the end user doesn't necessarily see that work in the product that hits the shelves, it actually does take place. That's how we get from A to B. These extra DRAM slots that you mentioned aren't for DRAM at all.
I noticed on the board it says not DDR2, not DDR1.
Yeah. With X79, we found that there were certain things or certain pins. I can't go into too many details, but we found there were certain things we could do with the processor on a hardware level in different scenarios that we could offer the end user options for. So if they were using the board or overclocking in a certain way, we could develop a module with certain hardware on it that helped the processor clock in a certain way. Some of this laid the foundation for OC socket in X99.
The OC socket being where you have extra pins to have voltage manipulation.
Yeah.
Which
so,
wasn't exposed by Intel.
No.
You had to go find it.
Yeah, but this is the kind of work that goes. So this is giving you the background story, the amount of R&D work it takes to find a feature like that. It's not slapdash. You need people that can think outside the box. And you need people that can execute that and bring it down into a tangible level for the retail market. And I think we've done that very well over the years. It's just something that end users historically haven't seen, right?
Well, so we have a board like this, which didn't make it to market, but certain features obviously came in later iterations.
Yeah.
But then we have something like this, which is an OC panel. Now, if any of our readers have seen any of the recent ROG reviews we've done, especially on the extreme level boards, Asus now has that OC panel that you can actually stick into a 5 1/4 inch bay with buttons, but it also has extra overclocking options inside, more fan headers, you know, VGA hot plug, that sort of thing. And this was essentially Genesis.
Yeah.
Genesis.
This is
Genesis.
This is what gave birth to that. That's what it evolved into.
And this would have started to exist sort of the time when both Raj and Gary were both writing it.
It wasn't a retail product.
No, this is light. But,
yeah. You know. It was seeded to power users, though, that were doing the extreme overclocking. So we wanted to give them the on-the-fly controls.
Can you imagine when Raj said, hey, I've got this for his review? We see lots of that extra hardware going. I mean, you guys have had things like the TPU and EPU dual processors now for what five, six generations.
Yes.
So going through. Now, something like TPU and EPU is hard to describe.
to the reader sometimes, just because it can be a feature that's both passive and active. If it's passive, then they don't do anything. If it's active, you actually need to adjust the controls. But this is actually, you know, custom silicon that you guys have, that's been designed internally.
Yes.
To be placed on the board. But in order to understand it very well, you need to have that deep sort of reading it. And it's very hard to do that sort of one line, what it does.
Yeah. It's not an easy thing to explain to the layman. They are microcontrollers. With those, we are able to override some of the things that the platform does by default. So that's some of the secret sauce that makes the board overclocking experience smooth. When you overclock certain platforms, you experience obstacles during post time. So we found ways of getting around those so that the end user can utilize that platform on a daily basis. It's no good having a platform that can overclock to a certain frequency, and then the next morning you go to boot it up and it doesn't post.
So, I've had that problem.
Yeah.
I've had that problem.
Some of this is the secret sauce of how to get around that. That's what it's for.
So when Vivian came to you, Gary, and said, hey, ROG exists.
Yes.
Here's a motherboard. Here's a set of features that it does. What went through your mind when that happened? Because obviously as a writer, you're thinking, how do I explain this?
Yeah, it was difficult. And I'm not going to lie here. Republica Gamers, I mean, where did that come from? Right. And I asked those questions.
Yeah.
And it was explained to me and it actually made sense that they were creating a community for gaming. And at that time, as we discussed earlier, you know, LAN parties and, FPS titles were huge and PC gaming, was at that time, you know, reaching another pinnacle.
Yeah.
And it all made sense. The first product, that we actually had at Anontech from ROG was the Crosshair board. And another editor, did the review on that one with the 590 chipset for the AMD platform. My first experience, was with the Striker board, with the 680i, for Intel. And NVIDIA had just launched that, and their launch partner was EVGA, and it was a well-sorted board.
Yeah.
The Striker came along, and there were some difficulties with it.
Teething issues.
Teething issues, and but it wasn't just the Striker board. MSI, Gigabyte, and the rest were having the same issues, and a lot of that had to deal with the fact that NVIDIA was very,
secretive.
Close,
yeah,
close.
It was. Secretive. They were secretive about that.
About the secret sauce in the BIOS.
And the chipset. Yeah.
And the chipset.
Yep.
And especially when it came to P1, P2, and GTL.
Performance. Yeah.
Yeah.
Settings. And those settings made or break that.
Okay.
Would make or break that board. And everybody was trying to reverse engineer that. So, one thing that really struck me as something special about ASUS at that time is that they sent an engineer over here. It was their lead R&D engineer.
They sent one to you?
Yes, to my home office. And we spent 3 days together.
Yeah.
sorting out the board. And once we got it dialed in, it performed just as well, if not a little bit better than the EVGA board. But there were only like 3 settings that worked.
Right, yeah.
Right? And if you could dial it in, it was great. But if you couldn't, it was a certain level of frustration.
So the interesting thing about that is ASUS has a product that they're trying to sell to the mass market, and even the reviewers having trouble getting it
to work.
Host, to boot.
Yes.
And it requires an engineer to come over to 3 days. And this is Albert, the senior, who's now head of
R&D.
R&D,
yes.
For motherboards at ASUS.
Right.
So how do you translate when, you know, you have that sort of issue and you have a company that's trying to sell 10,000? Because obviously the review isn't glowing, if that is the case.
The actual review did not go up.
Oh, right.
Right. I made a decision that after looking at the chipset and what was going on with the other work partners, to give everybody a pass.
Right.
Because we had boards in from, you know, our competitors, and they were not much better, if not worse.
Right.
But what impressed me most of ASUS was I heard back in a couple of weeks, and I had a string of BIOS updates.
Right.
And they eventually got the platform to working correctly. But they took some of the feedback that we had, and about 4 months later, the Striker Extreme came out.
Okay.
And it was a very good board. And while not absolutely perfect, it was extremely competitive that time with the leading board. And then eventually, probably about 3 or 4 months after that, ASUS figured out the secret sauce.
Okay.
And from that point on, all the way through, I actually had one running in a system for my son up until 2010.
Right.
And it was still being supported with BIOS updates.
Yeah.
So it turned out to be a terrific board. So
that's awesome.
But you know, I was really impressed with the level of commitment that they showed in addressing the issues, and then taking the feedback that we had and implementing that on future boards. And I'm sure Raja, you know, experienced that with ASUS. I think you had too.
If I don't, I speak to Vivian.
Okay.
Things happen. Things happen.
But we do listen.
Yeah. We take our users' trust very seriously.
Yes.
It's something that, you know, we make sure, obviously, you know, products are ready, and when there's a problem, we have to jump on it right away.
Well, one of the things that ROG does, you know, has had a longer time than everybody else is those ROG forums. And, you know, I have mentioned in several reviews, and I was, you know, you guys did when it was about that, hey, if you have a problem, there are actually people on the forum who will help you solve your issue. And, Raja, you tend to be...
Yeah, that was my first role. So PR wasn't what I was brought in for. I was the bridge between that community and R&D. So my job was to filter down the best feedback or look at what the users wanted.
Yeah.
And make sure that the platforms or the boards that we produced had that feature. But we don't just do it on ROG forums, because we recognize that some users are very loyal to certain communities that they don't necessarily want to leave. So my job is to be present on any major forum in North America and make sure that those users have a conduit or somebody that listens to them when things go right and wrong.
Yeah.
I feel that sets us apart somewhat. There aren't many vendors that I know of, at least in the forums that I frequent, and it is some of the largest forums, that have official presence, because that makes you a target.
Yeah. And so part of this roundtable for these guys is I want to put questions from our readers to ASUS just in general, because we have a lot of readers. Some of them are interested in ROG. Some of them have their ideas, they've had maybe a bad experience, or they just look at what's being written and they come to the conclusion. So I want to put a few things out to you from our readers, see how well they can be adjusted. I've changed some of the questions just to make them more format friendly, but the gist is still there. So first one is from Zodiac FML, who says, you should make an ROG smartphone with a 1080p resolution using a high-end Qualcomm chipset. So obviously ROG's PC hardware,
yes,
and laptops, and, you know, a small foray into SSDs, and there's also the PC peripherals.
Right.
But it's always been PC.
What about
smartphones?
Yeah. It's a very interesting question. But looking at it, and we've discussed it actually.
Yeah.
But you know, what would ROG bring to a smartphone, right?
Would you have a gaming smartphone?
Yeah, would you have a gaming smartphone, but something that we could also do in the Zen series, right, with the same processor?
Yeah.
So aesthetics-wise, you know, it would be an interesting exercise, but we're leaving the mobile phones with our Zen.
Okay.
Zen phone.
So give it a couple of generations for power to come through, and then maybe, especially when it comes to the gaming side, right?
Especially when it comes to gaming. And I, looking into the future, you know, there's probably some interesting things we can do with audio on the phone too.
Okay. Yeah.
With some new technologies coming out. So there's always that possibility.
Yeah.
But obviously if we do an ROG phone, you know, we want to differentiate that from other phones.
Hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. So second question, this is a modified version of the user JJJ, put on our comments list.
RJJ? Or?
No, not your JJ, okay. Our JJJ.
Triple J.
Triple J.
Yeah.
JJJ has very strong opinions on what he thinks about Republic of Gamers. A lot of them referring to specifically the cost.
Right.
So if a user can buy a mid-range, say a motherboard, buy a mid-range, the channel motherboard for $150, but the ROG equivalent is $250, that's another 60-70%. What is the user exactly getting for that 60-70%? What makes ROG worth the value? What are the value adds from your side that actually users want to see?
The main thing is that it provides that extra few percent of performance in certain areas that certain user groups want, right? So if it's on the overclocking side, it will overclock memory better. There's a following for that, right? But the fact is we have products or a product stack that is friendly for all budgets and all minds. So we cater to that audience that wants that. It's not a linear relationship between money and what you get back. We've never claimed that it is.
Yeah.
But there are people that will pay for the extra engineering and the work that I highlighted there that we have to do. That has to be recouped somewhere. All that extra stuff, even though it doesn't give you a linear return, does give you something, and there are people that want that. We wouldn't be successful in the market if that wasn't true.
So, from my perspective, when people buy something like a motherboard or a graphics card, there's several things they put in the line. Usually, first is typically how much budget do I have? What the features, how does it look for a lot of people? I mean, we're talking about LAN gaming. A lot of LAN gaming is, well, what PC do you have and what does it look like? And does it have lights? Does it not have lights? Is it stylish? Is it classy? Is it kitschy? So, there will be a few people who buy ROG for that reason, the fact that it's red and black. Every motherboard that I review, at least now, you know, I get that reviewer's guide that comes through and it says, you know, we have, you know, upgraded capacitors, we have upgraded power phases, we're actually using things like T topology on the memory to help push a few margins. Now, I get why some users want that. They want the peace of mind, they want the best, or they have the financial wherewithal to go to a system integrator and say, I want an ROG platform.
Right. But there's also the bread is software, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah.
It's more tailored for that audience, right? The UEFI is as well. There's a lot more work that goes into it that makes that experience smooth.
But there will be people who don't want any of that. They just want something to plug in.
We've got products for them.
Yes.
So we have to cater to all. We're not telling everybody buy a certain product.
So our ROG has moved into that B-series chipset.
Yeah.
They've moved into the lower-end chipsets. It's moved into certain markets where they want that low-cost option, but it still has...
They wanted the aesthetics, they wanted some of the ROG fundamentals, and they didn't want to have to, or they didn't want to pay for overclocking or whatever else.
Yeah.
So the product stack has had to evolve to cater for that.
Yeah. Especially with Z170, the cost differential is not that much anymore, right?
Well, so that actually...
Especially considering the additional features that we're providing. So.
So that actually leads to another question from Jason Elmore, who asked...
Before we move on, though, one thing I will say is that ROG brand is responsible for making all of those other cheaper products as good as they are, because if there's anything good that comes out of an ROG product that we can roll out into the market and then drive price down, we do it. So it's a feeder in many ways.
Yeah, and let me just add, I don't know if you're aware, but we design these ROG products. First of all, every chipset, every generation, we look at the entire our stack and think about what possibly can come out of it, whether it's in the ROG flavor, in our signature, in tub, whatever the case may be, form factors, price points. And we're very cognizant of this kind of a question. You know, yeah. If somebody is at a you know, looking for a $200 board, looking at a signature versus ROG, and there is a cost difference, what are they really getting at the end of the day? We're not just charging a premium for no reason, right? These ROG boards are designed from the ground up. A lot of these things are really, you know, kind of like Roger was saying, we have to basically take everything apart and then start figuring out where the secret sauces can be.
Yeah.
And on average, the ROG boards take about twice as many hours compared to other products.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that kind of goes behind the scenes. It's really more than the standard feature sets or even the aesthetics that we see.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll tell you, even, you know, things like the Southbridge or, you know, any of these very interesting designs, that takes time and yeah. takes a lot of iterations. Every time we go back to headquarters, you know, we have the privilege of being very plugged in with our team. And so we will sit around the table and we'll debate. Is that the right shape? Is that the right shade of gray? Is that the right type of material? And honestly, you know, we'll debate these things because that's how people are going to perceive what the value is to them.
And then there's certain things that anytime you move out of anything that's traditional or off the shelf, if you have to do a custom, even an inductor value, if you have to do a custom microcontroller, the setup costs are significant.
Yeah.
Right. So we have to be cognizant of how much we're spending on the product to bring it to market versus how much that's going to be costing the consumer. So that's why those boards cost more. There is tangible stuff behind the scenes that goes into it.
So I want to, speaking cost,
yeah.
I mean, we had a question from Jason Elmore, which relates to one motherboard that I recently reviewed and another one that's coming up that
yeah.
I have tested. But is $500 too much for a Z170 motherboard, given that the price of an X99 platform could be less and you get more cores?
It that always gets a little bit difficult where you've got a desktop platform that's infringing on the space of an enthusiast platform that offers more in return, like more PCIe lanes or more
yeah.
memory density or whatever else. There are people that want to push a given platform way beyond its capabilities.
Yeah.
And we then have to over-engineer the board suitably and make sure there are enough features on to cover the entire gamut of the audience.
Yeah.
I think that's what's made ROG successful. We've done niche products, but we've always kept enough of everything on them that the entire gamut will have something to look forward to in that product. Now, on these chipsets between Z170 and X99, we're in a state of transition for storage, for example.
Yeah.
Right. We've seen SATA 3 to SATA 6G was a very slow transition.
Yeah.
Last 18 months, though, we've gone from having M.2. SATA Express had a brief glint, never really saw much. But all of these things happened in a very rapid time frame. So the chipsets themselves don't cater for an ideal thing. So sometimes we have to enable features on an interim product that the market is asking for, right?
Yeah.
So sometimes a product doesn't immediately catch the eye as being value for money versus the enthusiast platform. But at the same time, in that interim period, it offers something that the market is looking for.
So that seems like U.2.
Exactly, on board. Yeah, see, so we have to do all of that in between.
Especially dual U.2. So.
Dual
U.2?
Yes. Where?
It's coming.
It's coming. It's coming. You've heard it here first. So another question from 7 Amood. Do you have future plans to do motherboard waterproofing, sort of oleophobic, super hydrophobic coating, which we have seen on other products from other vendors?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think if we saw a massive demand for it, we'd do it.
Okay.
At the moment, I haven't seen huge amounts of pickup. It's a nice value add in certain ways, but I haven't had overwhelming demand. That's one of the first times somebody's asked that question. I'm in the communities, right?
Okay.
So if I get asked it enough, I would take it back to HQ and say, okay, let's try this and see if it's feasible.
Okay, so another question here from Dreamer77DD. will we see a dual socket ROG platform in the future? If B-clock overclocking on high-end desktop Skylake is a thing, would that be a thing that ROG would be interested in?
Now that the brand has expanded into not just being a high-end focused or high-dollar focused, there is some possibility of it happening, because core ROG fundamentals like overclocking were the prominent part of what we were doing for a long time.
Yeah.
And then the platforms and the chipsets have changed so that certain things are locked out. If it made sense, that's the best answer I can give on that. It would have to make sense for us to do it, because it's no good just doing it on color. We've got server and workstation boards that can do everything like that. It just isn't in the color scheme, right?
Yeah.
And you get
the gaming software.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's subtle differences here and there. If we saw enough demand, we'd do it. And then you have to look at what do gamers really want? Where does the performance come from? Is it really from a dual CPU setup, or is it from GPUs, or is it, you know, storage? I think those are the things that we need to focus on primarily.
Okay. So change tactics a little bit here. A question from Bosch. Sorry if I'm pronouncing it incorrectly, but laptops. Obviously, ROG has a range of laptops,
yes,
and has done for 3, 4, 5 years now. But obviously, the big player in that gaming laptop space as well is MSI, and they have the GT80 Titan SLI that costs $4,500,
right,
if you're on the high spec. Would we see an ROG equivalent competing in that price space? Is it worth? I mean, there's the new water cooling.
Yes, there's the GX700, and it competes and also beats.
We've reviewed the Titan. Yes. We need to review.
Yes,
the ROG
it's coming, and it offers better performance.
So, but is water cooling a thing that should be introduced into that market, into the laptop market?
I think it's a very interesting concept and exercise. It provides some additional performance features otherwise not available.
Yeah.
Yeah, without it, you couldn't.
Yeah.
You can only go so far. You're constrained by the power requirements of the GPU and how to cool it, right?
Yeah. In the thermals.
Yeah.
Even on the CPU side, because we're allowing, you know, significant overclocking on
the CPU. Yeah, the 6820H.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So there's another question by Boesh, who asks, are there any other plans for larger sort of 18-inch laptops and non-widescreen laptops, so 4:3, 2:9, 16:9, the sort of extra 10 to 15% pixels that could help some readers? Is there any? Well, you must have spoken about it internally, right?
Yes, we have, and that's a great question. I've been a big fan of 16:10,
yeah,
for a long time. However, most of the panel manufacturers no longer are. Right.
So is it just a question of sourcing?
It's a question of sourcing and then cost.
Right.
For doing it. And that type of low volume and a significant cost increase is something most consumers are unwilling to accept.
Yeah.
We have discussed it and continue to discuss it, right? Especially the larger panel sizes on something maybe with the ZenBook type chassis, you know,
yeah,
the light, but you know, having that
the sort of premium $1,300-$1,400
stuff. So if something comes to fruition there, you'll be the first one to know.
Excellent. So one question that's going to be in Raj's backyard from I Am Kyle.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to see motherboards that are more modular and offer more customization options, and he's specifically thinking in terms of having, you know, swapping in and out audio codecs or network ports.
Yeah.
Now, how feasible is that, and is it a thing that ROG could do?
In some ways, it exists already because you've got PCIe slots. That most of that stuff interfaces with the platform via PCIe, right? So we either go with the open standard or we make an ASUS one, which I don't think would do us many favors. And then in times where we have had plug-in cards for stuff like that, it does turn some people off because you're using up some of the real estate they want to give to something else.
But in that situation, say you already have say, a real tech on board and you add in a creative card, what if the codec that was on board was in sort of, you know, a pin compatible that you could just take in and pop out? Same with the NIC, right?
It's very difficult to do that because the pinouts of various codecs from various vendors are different.
Right.
So there is no socket that would cater to all of them. Plus, the tooling for that would be, even if there was, the tooling would be astronomical.
Right.
And people are fighting over spending $5 extra on a board, let alone that much more. So I think that's not very viable. And then you've got to look at, well, why don't you like the codecs that are in the marketplace? What are you struggling with? Why do you think that codec is not good enough, right? In the past, when we have dealt with other vendors, he mentioned Wolfson. I had a Maximus 6 formula board during the ES phase with a Wolfson chipset on it. The issue was they had a 9-month turnaround for a driver. That's not workable in the consumer space.
So is that necessarily the benefit of Realtek? They have the ability to turn around?
That's some of it. And actually, their 1150 codec is pretty damn good. And then if somebody has an aversion to the fact that, okay, we don't like the DAC that is part of that codec, we bypass it on the formula boards or on the entire Maximus series now and use an ESS DAC.
Yeah.
So that all that codec is essentially doing is passing the digital stream to another digital to analog converter.
Right.
So it's pretty much benign in that scenario. So I think the aversion to Realtek is a little bit ill-informed more than anything.
Okay.
I don't think there's anything massive to be had by going to other vendors per se. You can do it in different ways that suit the, you know, what you're trying to achieve. Yeah.
Okay. So I had a question I wanted to put to you guys as part of the Q&A.
Okay.
Because you recently announced the Extreme Assembly, which came with a 10 gigabit Ethernet card.
Yes.
And we've had one other motherboard manufacturer who's put 10 gigabit Ethernet on the board, on their high-end board. And I got a press release from you guys today saying that there's a 10 gig switch in the pipeline.
Yes.
So there must be 10 gig on the brain. Using RJ45, how is 10 gig perceived within the ROG space internally?
We're feeling it out. We're seeing if there is a market for it. And some of that we do have to do. And like I said, the ROG brand is the place where new technologies for those extreme people that want to be on that cutting edge.
Yeah.
That's where we roll them out and feel out the market and see if it's feasible. That helps us determine where we want to go with that technology. If there's good uptake on it, it helps us bring it down to more affordable price points also. And what I think one thing that sets us apart is we are successful in that space. We're not just on a client, right? We supply routers, we do switches.
Yeah.
So that allows us to have the ecosystem, but we need to feel it out and see if the market is there first.
Okay. Yeah. From a personal perspective, I think, you know, obviously everybody who's interested in 10 gig knows that it has that initial layout cost.
Yeah.
And whether it's going to be worth it in the long term.
Mm.
So anything that can be bought to sort of bring that cost down, you know, can get more people enthused for those who can use it. I mean, obviously there's going to be a group of people that won't ever need it.
We have to start somewhere. Yeah.
But also, you know, if ROG is going to those enthusiasts, prosumers, I think 10 gigs is a good place to start.
Yeah.
On there, personally. First one.
I know you're a strong advocate for it. I know.
See, it's not just me. You know, Ganesh likes it as well.
Okay.
Ganesh likes it as well.
Yeah.
And so for a final question from Shadow 7047932. He is still running an i7-920 and will be upgrading for a few months. The PC has been in use 7 years. With CPUs having pretty long-lasting staying power nowadays, how does ASUS plan to deal with it? So by extension of this, you know, you take our recent Skylake review, people are still running Sandy Bridge.
Yep.
And a large majority of users, in fact, are saying they still don't need to upgrade.
Yeah.
What happens when a new chipset comes along? Especially on, you know, the ROG platform is the high-end enthusiast. And if the high-end enthusiast doesn't want to upgrade, why should the mid-range?
That's why the brand evolved from just being motherboards to doing GPUs, displays, some forays into storage as well. So we look at the entire system. We saw long ago that just doing motherboards wasn't really where what people were looking for, or it wasn't part of the whole system, right? There's various parts of the system that give that performance, and the architectures have changed to reflect that. And we have been operating in those spaces for a number of years. So if the longevity of a platform has extended, we're very current, and we offer solutions for people in areas where they will upgrade.
Right. So
we're not reliant on them necessarily doing so.
So right. if you're a gamer, chances are 7 years, you're not going to have the same GPU.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah. We cater for that, right?
Or storage technology now, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a significant increase in performance for the platform.
But yeah. Anyone's.
I think 7 years ago, I was running one of those 10K Raptors. I wouldn't be wanting to run one of them now.
No.
I'll be honest. Well, you know, I'd like to thank Raj, Gary, and Vivian.
Thank you
for being with us today and being part of our CES 2016 coverage. I do have the Extreme board in, tested, ready for review. So ask our readers to keep an eye out for that, and you know, keep in tune for the rest of our CES coverage.
Thank you. Thanks.